The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
Hi, friends. It's Carrie Dahl. Thank you so much for venturing into the inner circle with me. If you subscribe to my podcast and have been listening for a while, thank you. I appreciate you. If you're new, welcome to my circle, where the power of story is honored and I believe all voices need and deserve to be heard. As a former news anchor turned podcast host and public speaking coach, I know that stories are the most powerful way we connect as human beings. I feel privileged so many of you trust me with your stories, whether in my private Inner Circle Facebook group or right here on my podcast. Your story is your gift. Thank you for allowing me to share it with the world. Friends, today's podcast is filled with help for teenagers who are struggling with their mental and emotional health. I don't have to tell any of you listening right now how challenging the last 2 years have been for them since COVID set in. Their normal was disrupted in every possible way. They couldn't see their friends. They couldn't go out. They couldn't go through rites of passage, like graduations, for example. So many things were taken from them. It's no wonder many of them are struggling. You know, I actually had dinner the other night with a friend of mine who happens to be a medical examiner. And she told me that she's seen two troubling trends right now. Teen suicides and deaths from opioids are at an all-time high, a level she has never seen before in her career. And while she is an expert and a doctor, highly trained in the work that she does, she is still a human being and admitted that seeing so many teenage deaths weighs heavily on her heart. So today we are going to get help from a brilliant and accomplished author who will offer some solid takeaways for all of you listening. She has written and published tens of hundreds, if not thousands, of articles and books, and she's going to talk about how to wire our brain in a new way. She has a PhD in learning theories and cognitive science and loves to dig into issues like how do we learn, how do we lead, and what does our brain have to do with it? She spent some 26 years living and working in New York City and has also traveled to over 20 countries in the world to help diverse leaders and learners accomplish things by using parts of their brains that they hadn't used before. Recently, her New York publishers reached out to her and asked her to write a growth mindset book based on her 50 years of research to respond to deep needs they saw in their data about teens' mental and emotional struggles. She's an expert in the area, but she's also lived it growing up in what she calls a dysfunctional family, which she will talk about. Wow, it is such an honor and a pleasure to welcome Ellen Weber to the Inner Circle. I am so excited for this conversation, Ellen.
I am too. I almost feel that I should step aside and let an expert come and sit in this seat and go for it. But I'm so excited about our exchanges. I've already learned from you, Carrie.
Oh, and feelings are mutual, Ellen, in our conversations leading up to this podcast. So let's dig in, shall we? Some 26 years in living in New York City, you thought that you were going to retire so you could spend some time with your grandchildren, perhaps live a quieter life. And then your publisher pulls you out of retirement for one final book. Why did you decide to do it?
That's a good question. First of all, it wasn't really my publisher. I had not published with that particular publishing house before. And I was intrigued by how they not only tapped into what I love to do, was to think about how the brain is wired and how we can wire it more effectively. But I was keen to go with the fact that they use data rather than publishing interests. So they went and found the data, and then they came looking for a person who could write, but who could also address that data in an empirically supported way. Mm-hmm. And that intrigued me. I had never heard of that approach before. I tend to jump to challenges, as you know, mm-hmm. and I couldn't resist that. And I also was in lockdown with COVID, and I think they gave me 4 months to write the book. So it worked well for me in that I was locked down, and I now had a chance to think deeply about what you just described so brilliantly in your opening. Is we've taken care of ourselves as adults. We've taken care of the babies, because if we don't, they can't eat. And we've forgotten the teens in the middle. And they have been sadly left behind because they didn't have to worry about paying the mortgage and they didn't need us to spoon feed them. We've left them behind.
Mm-hmm. And we need to help them.
Oh, yes, we can.
And we will dig into that a little bit later in the podcast. I'm going to make our listeners wait for their takeaways. And I want to, first of all, dig into your story and talk about your childhood, because you said to me that you grew up in a dysfunctional family. And one of the things that resonated with me, amongst many things, you said you didn't know what it was to cherish or to be cherished. What does that mean? And why is that so important?
Well, that's a great question, because it's also a difficult one, because we used to read that when you went through really hard times, you were the guru leader. You were the strong one with the resilience and the grit. Guess what? Lately, we find that's not at all true. In fact, if you were nurtured, loved, and cherished, you are the guru. You are the strong one. You're the one we should be throwing our support at. And of course, we help others who mm-hmm. had terrible dysfunctions, but the healing needs are high among people that were left on their own on the street at 14, like I was. And so because I didn't have the comfort level and the wiring of being cherished by either parent, my mom died, my dad couldn't cope. And because of that, I didn't have that wiring built within me. Those neuron connectors were not connected in me. So I was a walking piece of need. Some people reach out to drugs. I don't even think I was smart enough to do that. I reached out to staying on an honor roll because that's the only thing that made me feel good in a day.
That is extraordinary. Tell us more about that. 14, living on the streets, and you had several siblings as well. What all happened to you?
Many of my siblings took their lives, I'm sad to say. We were about as dysfunctional as is possible to be. I remember having no hope. Birthdays came and went without recognition. Christmas came and went. It was, if I were to go back today with my neuro understanding and I handed myself a bottle of Prozac with serotonin, I think even that could have helped me, because I now know I didn't ever take Prozac. I'm not against anything synthetic. Whatever you and your experts in life help you to become a better person is fine with me. It works. But the Prozac wasn't the serotonin for me. I had to figure out how to cultivate it myself. And that was for me through learning how to problem solve, for learning how to stay away from the groups on the street that I felt were speaking a language I didn't want to speak in my future. I had to navigate a way to get to the goals that I was trying to set for myself in my dysfunctional brain. I really want to add that, because I wasn't this paragon of wonder or courage. I had none of that. I was terrified of the dark. And it was getting dark, and I didn't have a penny, and I longed to live in a castle. So I was about as dysfunctional as is possible, but through grace, through faith, through friends, and through a mind that was able to figure it out, I somehow stayed alive long enough to get the serotonin in me operative.
Ellen, you were 14. How the heck did you pay the bills? What did you do?
Actually, I paid them in such dysfunctional ways. I worked two or three jobs at a time in the Paramount Theater after school, leading people to see the movies. All of those ways that people without any much education can find themselves enough coffers to put into the rent. And I was behind at times. I ate dysfunctionally. I didn't eat for 3 weeks, and then I would go buy a plate-sized cinnamon roll with the only money I had. I didn't do things well and functionally, but I figured it out through a series of many, many failures and a few successes because of a few friends or people in my life, like yourself, Carrie, who cheer for other people who care about this world. I had people like that stepping into my life at opportune times to surprise the life out of me with goodness and care. And somehow through that, living in a little rooming house in downtown Halifax, I made it beyond the crisis point and into a university class where I could get a student loan and become rich overnight.
That truly is extraordinary that through all of those challenges, you were able to pay bills, rent your own apartment, and then venture off to university. So what did you study in university and what were your bills like when you finished?
Well, my going back to university was a bit of a phenomenon in itself because I went back by being pushed around by friends. I kept asking the question, why is the school system letting us down? Why are we not looking at the real definition of what it means to be smart? Why aren't we doing that? And they were so disgusted with me. My intelligent friends kept shoving me toward higher and higher degrees until I finally got a PhD and developed a model for a growth mindset. But how did they get paid? They got paid with great difficulty, as many of the teens facing university today probably look. But all of a sudden, just after I finished my PhD and I was teaching at the University of Toronto at the moment, a friend of a friend of mine invited me for lunch, which surprised me because I didn't know him. He and his wife lived nearby in Ontario and asked me what my student loan balance was. I remember thinking, well, that's not a very good question to ask somebody you don't even know. And why are you prying into places that I am quite a private person, especially about my many failures because they were so on overload. I told him $60,000, which would probably $10 or $20 out of square. And he pulled out a check and wrote me a check for $60,000 and paid off my student loan.
What?
That actually happened in Ontario, in Toronto.
How did you react? Just take me back to that.
I couldn't believe it, but I believed it far greater than my banker believed it, because when I walked to the Royal Bank and handed them this check with $10.13 in my account, they looked at it as if to say, and you expect us to believe this? And so they called around to make sure that this person really existed. He's the Wall Street of Canada kind of person. He's a tremendous believer in good people, in goodness. And his faith is what took him in his mind to where he got. So he said he wasn't giving this as a gift. He was investing in what he heard was my life. And so wow. I had investors in my life where other people had parents. And I consider my tremendous losses in life, loss of an entire childhood, loss of being able to be in sports. I'm now an avid golfer. And I hold
for
on
you.
To that. Oh, I go for it. Jerry. We'll have to golf one day. I am only time you'll find me very competitive. But not being able to take part in sports, I had to go home and do dishes. That kind of a lost childhood was made up to me in so many ways later on. And so I feel able to be able to say to teens, hold on to whatever capability you own. You will differ from me and everybody around you, but look into that to see the inner kindness within you. And that I found by happenstance. I had no mercy toward myself. Therein, I did not know how to cherish myself. So I had no capability inwardly to cherish you or anybody else. I might be jealous of you. I might feel envious about all you accomplish, or I might feel judgmental about one failure I saw from you. But without mercy and without cherishment, that's a new word I just made up.
Love it.
Inside of me, I didn't have the ability to stand as you so often do in the bleachers and cheer others on. By great delight and fortune, I was able to understand the brain and the emotions to the point where I could cultivate those, knowing that my tools from earlier life were my tools and I could use them. I did.
So you didn't stop at a degree. You continued on to a PhD. Tell me about that.
I did. I finished my degree. I went on to do a master's to see what is it that we are doing wrong in the learning systems across universities and across high schools. What is it we're doing wrong that doesn't seem to be pairing up with what I understand to be the brain that got me through at 14 and keeps me alive today? What is it that we're not lining up with that's cultivating that brain and those emotions, which I had none of, that were healthy? Mm-hmm. And I kept asking that question. And I went back to do a master's, met Dr. Howard Gardner from Harvard University, who's written me 25 of the most encouraging letters I've ever received in life about my work. But he developed 8 ways of knowing. And immediately I saw it. I saw that where you or I might use 1 or 2 of those 8 that are not measured, because the schools typically measure 2 only. Then I saw that the many people I was mentoring, helping, and even adult leaders, I was doing wrong. I was cultivating my own capabilities in working with them as teacher, mentor, whatever you want to call me, leader. I was a leader of leaders. I won leadership awards in places like New York for leading leaders, but I wasn't cultivating that among the young or my own age, because I didn't understand that they might have 2 that I don't recognize very well. They're lower. I have them, but they might be lower in me. Your ability for kinesthetics, Carrie, probably would never be alive in me at that level, but I still can walk with you and talk with you, because I know that I now learned that IQ is fluid, not fixed. And so whatever intelligence I work with each day, I can grow those babies up. Yeah. And so that was exciting to me.
Okay. So from there, you did your master's and then went on to get your PhD?
I did a master's, and it was very shortly after that that I knew I wanted to take Howard Gardner's work of 8 intelligences into a model that was broader and wider. And it took in parts of the brain that we have not been understanding well or using, things like your serotonin coursing through your veins today. Just before the camera came on, you dumped a little bucket of it over me by a couple of words you said to me. It only took a couple of words, but it was like a bucket of serotonin. It probably came back to you. That's the nature of serotonin. But it also came to me. It quieted me down. It set me up. And it opened me to a success in our conversation and a learning from you and from people we're discussing today. Yeah. So I learned that also our teens are anxious because they have cortisol surging through their brains as it was surging through my terrified brain at 14. I figured out how to move that cortisol, which, by the way, either of those chemicals will change the chemistry of your day. And both of them are at 10% in your brain and 90% in your gut and flowing through your blood. So you just get shut down very easily by cortisol being dumped in unexpectedly through a person's words, their body language, their unfaithfulness, whatever it is we do. But I learned that within myself and within our teens today, we're like Joseph Conrad wrote when he said in The Heart of Darkness that the mind is capable of anything because it contains all things, our past and our future. I agree with that. I can prove that empirically through my research, and I decided to go on and study so that I could create a model which not only did I prove empirically could get higher achievement, but also could it get higher motivation. I was at UBC, one of the top universities in Canada. So I decided to get what I thought was the best scientist on board to be my head of state in my university, Dr. Galen Erickson, an amazing scientist and person, humane person. And because I wanted to prove, as many profs told me, you can't prove it will get higher achievement. There's no way to do that. So stick with motivation. I wasn't willing to do that. I had put everything on the line at 14 and I decided I was going for it scientifically. So I kept on trying to prove it empirically that it got higher achievement, and I did it. And now it's been proven in many PhDs to get both higher achievement and higher motivation simply by rewiring what was already wired when you were born, shaped when you were babies, but still is up for rewiring daily in what you do.
There are so many concepts that you just threw down that I want to dig into. All right. But first thing I need to do, I want to hold space for you and for your achievements and extend my own sincerest congratulations, because what you have accomplished is really nothing short of remarkable. For you to be put on the streets as a teenager and to find a way out to eventually, you know, go to university, have this angel come into your life, pay your bills, master's, PhD, Harvard's in the picture. Wow, Ellen, that's huge. Like, it really is. That gives anyone listening to this hope that all obstacles can be overcome with determination and serotonin boosts and beyond, and lots of hard work, obviously. So allow me to say that if I can. The second thing I want to talk about is just, you know, you talk about these concepts that we don't have two intelligences, we have eight. Can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Well, if you think of yourself in a castle and you choose to look at a problem by getting new ideas, and you choose eight different and distinctively different towers to look through in that castle, you will be looking through your eight intelligences. And I will suggest what those are, but I like to think of it as a castle, because you're looking at a parking lot through one. That's a very different thing from a fluid river in another glance through. So our intelligences allow us to look at problems differently. When I was teaching at the University of Toronto many years ago, one of the faculty came up to me and said, I really want to write an article so I can move on in my career. I have to write and publish peer-reviewed articles. You write all the time. I don't write. I can't write. I can't even spell. And he was the head of the PE department. The guy was brilliant. His name was Andy Anderson. Brilliant. And he said, but if you will help me write an article, I'll be the first name in it. You can be the second name about the brain and golf. If you will do that and put it in a top magazine in Canada, if you will do that, I will teach you to golf, because he knew that I had always wanted to learn. And I had no idea. We laughed our way through that article. And I saw one of the brightest men and enjoyable men I've ever worked with. He died of a brain tumor not too long after, which is such sad news. But Andy Anderson and I went for 3-4 hour dinners where people would come up and say, whatever you're eating, we want, because we laughed our way through stupidity of a university, any university, to say you're not intelligent because you don't spell. That embodies everything I want to say to teens. You're intelligent when you tell us how you are smart. How you are smart, not how smart you are. So I've changed the question. And we wrote an article that went to Jopard, which is one of the top kinesthetic journals in Canada. And I think it was called Golfing with the Brain in Mind. I think it was. And we just laughed. I was calling them sticks in a bag, and he's going, whoa, 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 right there, whoa. and then I would say, here's how the lesion in your brain works. And he'd say, listen, the only people I care about and work with talk about lesions in the grass, okay? And we just put each other to the test. That's what our teens should be doing. They should be working with their strengths. The article published, we learned so much from each other. And I golf in a league today. We have won many golf. I'm no Tiger Woods, but I've won many golf awards because of Andy Anderson's willingness to take a non-kinesthetic person and teach me using his capabilities while we learned how to write together.
Ellen, wait, I I you can't leave that. For all the golfers that are listening to this, they're going to know, what did he teach you? What was the essence of that article?
Well, what is brilliant is, out of that article, I have come up with an algorithm, which is what I use to win tournaments. And the algorithm only has three bullets because your brain has a working memory that holds tiny, tiny bits of data. So when I'm teaching my grandchildren or teens how to golf, I don't want to fill their brain with all the things they must do. So I go to the algorithm, which I think comes out of what Andy taught me. And it's the first bullet. I have three bullets only that I hold in my brain. And I not only say them every time, but I make my body do them. I watch my body do them. Head down, sweep the floor, head down, sweep the floor, and V it through, because I used to be using only one arm and getting a shorter tee than I should get, because I wasn't putting my hands in that V that uses two arms to get it off the tee. So V it through is V-E-E it through. So head down, sweep the floor, V it through. That's my algorithm. And that's the short, that's the skinny of what my dear friend Andy Anderson taught me.
And you think of that every time you hit a ball?
I do, because that is the one algorithm over 26 years of golfing that's brought me most success, and that gets the people I teach off the ground enjoying golf instead of seeing it as this big complex thing that only a few people can accomplish well. The opposite is true. You can go out having thought you would hate golf, and you can laugh your way through nine holes if you go with the brain in mind. So I like to think that I golf with the brain in mind and with a growth mindset that I try to teach teens to do in their lives. You know, we're teaching teens that being talented and successful should be their goal, but that doesn't mean doing everything perfect. It means believing that their intelligence and personality holds the ability to grow daily by what they do. Mm-hmm. And they have at least eight. Let's take a look at how we see you in all eight, and that might help people to understand how they operate in a more personable way. A mathematical intelligence also includes logic. I don't know your mathematical skills. I probably would know if I could either see your bank account or if I could tell what your algebra scores were in 11th grade, but I don't choose to look that way. I see logic in you as the causation of syllogisms that I see again and again. You say, because this and this, then we can expect this. That logic comes from sheer mathematic intelligence. And I like the way it's fun and easy for me to access in you. Your verbal linguistic intelligence, I see in your love for interview questions. Mm-hmm. You ask questions people most want to answer. That is sheer verbal intelligence. When I heard you reading the opening this morning, I thought, there's verbal intelligence. And so we can shine it through in many, many, many ways. I show in the book endless ways that each of these intelligence will manifest. But the next one is musical or rhythmic intelligence. And that can be a cadence in your words. For me, I have used it quite differently. I do write a lot. And so I'm not what you would consider traditionally musical. I've never had those opportunities in my life, but I adore music that moves my brain to a new level. So I've made music into a white noise for myself, and I might put instrumental Christmas carols on in the background, and I'm writing chapter 7 on how to get rid of your panic. And so a great musician couldn't do that, because they would be dancing to the words or seeing the notes, but I'm dumb to all that. So I have figured out how music has become one of my most intelligent motivators for all of my important work. It's just exciting how you use these intelligences. And so I also, every time I use it, of course, I grow it. So I'm growing musically. Then you have your visual spatial. It might be the way you dress up or down. It might be the way you design a room. It might be the way you simply use a poster to explain difficult concepts of the brain. I made 6 really important brain facts into Namungos, because Namungos are cool characters.
What are Namungos?
Oh, come on, Kier, you've never heard of Namungo?
No.
I'm not surprised, because I invented it. I wanted to teach my 2-year-old grandchildren all about their brains, and I felt they were a lot smarter than me. They would get it, but I didn't want to use 15-syllable words. So right. I created mnemongos for each of the 6 characters I wanted to teach them. Zero is the character for serotonin. Court is the character we run from and play games with and take swords after for cortisol. Mig is the mnemongo for, and I did mnemongos because my little guy wasn't into fairies. Otherwise, I could have used them as fairies in our that live in our brain. And then adventure characters, my little gal wasn't so thrilled about those living in our brain. So I was in a state of complexity, which most of my life has been. And I decided I will come up with a new word. I have 6 mnemongos, and we built tree houses for these mnemongos. We chased them around the yard. We dug up goodies that they buried for us in my backyard. And I taught my children how to move with and rewire their brain when they feel panicked or overwhelmed or unloved. So that is one of my visual. Oh, then I got characters that were life-size cardboard characters made out of these, and I would travel to 20 countries to do brain conferences. Mm-hmm. And once it got out about my mnemongos, they became much more popular than I was. And it was like, if I couldn't come and I was sick, they were almost saying, well, just put your mnemongos on the plane and send them over. They were not willing to let me leave the mnemongo characters. So they would always be around me in these. And the dean of the graduate school where I taught about the brain as well heard about them and invited them to come in and meet him, and they did. So fun. They started out for babies, but most of what we say intelligently to a 2-year-old is quite intelligent for a Madeleine Longall speaking 60-year-old, most mm-hmm. of them. If we say it well, we don't talk down to anybody if we're smart. If we say it clearly and well, people should be able to connect and run with it in fun ways. So now the bodily kinesthetic intelligence, of which I had very, very little, I know I have it in my DNA, its potential is there, never have been developed. Andy Anderson got me going. I'm still not athletically inclined. I could sit more than I could run, but I've done little things like I don't use elevators. I walk upstairs constantly. I golf every time I get the chance, and I use my bodily movement. It could also be building a mock-up. It could be going out and building your own log cabin. It's the hand-eye coordination on a football field. We put down these precious teenagers or men or women who run and catch a ball and run with it, but don't spell well. We call them jocks, or in a diminishing way. Mm-hmm. But if we know the brain, we never do that. We say, please teach me all that you know about that flying ball and how it is that I could catch one and head it over to the end line like you do. Teach me. Teach me how you think logically instead of calling me a male thinker. Teach me. And when we begin to understand our brain, we come as a learner to every situation, as a mutual mentor to every person we meet with. Then there's the interpersonal, the person who we love to be around, we love to learn from, and we know who's learning from us. That person who has that ability will have many friends, but will never be overwhelmed with friendships because they are interpersonally smart. We grow that intelligence by practicing it daily, maybe smiling at an immigrant that we looked down on foolishly, maybe buying coffee for somebody that we judged harshly. That's how we grow our interpersonal capabilities. And it's fun to do it and challenge ourselves to grow. And in my book, I actually have an MI, multiple intelligence survey. So teens can come out saying, wow, I'm stronger in these 4, weaker in these 4. And here are some activities I can do to grow these weak babies. And then the intrapersonal is so cool because that's about you when nobody else is here. When somebody like me is not throwing buckets of serotonin over your head. And when I stood alone on the street in Halifax, am I moral? Am I immoral? Am I ethical? Am I unethical? Who am I when the lights go out and nobody's looking at me? And there's nobody else can give me that. I have to develop that in the deep inner recesses of my brain. Often that can be the amygdala, which stores all of my ethical responses to things, my moods, that kind of thing. So that's my intrapersonal. And some people, I know Howard Gardner quite well, have known him for many years. And at Harvard, as a matter of fact, that my work is named in his book, Reframing Intelligence from Basic Books. But having said that, I've seen scholars all over the world try to take one of these that they do best and make it preeminent. I've questioned him again and again over breakfasts or whatever. Is any preeminent? He says, no, I agree with him. No, none is preeminent. So intrapersonal is so deep and so important and so exciting. If you become alive in yourself, Carrie, that you would love to go for dinner with yourself tonight and enjoy toasting that glass of wine to an imaginary friend, then you are intrapersonally brilliant. It's so cool. And so, but it, none is preeminent. So the last but not least of these intelligences that we can shine through is naturalistic. You will see it shine through a farmer or an agriculturalist faster than somebody like me, or maybe faster than you. You'll see it by a person who hikes beside a babbling brook in order to get a new idea to write an article. You'll see that naturalistic, a person who goes out into nature to use the sequences or patterns of nature in order to solve everyday problems. Yeah, aren't they exciting?
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundel, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So exciting. So this is the essence, these intelligences of your book for teenagers.
It's not the essence. I started out with it being the essence in my master's, and I did it with graduate students, and I had amazing projects that all would get D minus from you. If you came in as an assessor and were objective, they would all get D minus. And the students were all mad at me the first year and saying, but we love your class community. Everybody's so happy in it. How can we get D's? And the reason they could is because you can't use just going after your intelligence in my model for a growth model. There are three or four other steps that you need to take. And one is questioning your possibilities. You need to say things like, how am I smart, rather than how smart am I? You need to ask questions like, is it possible to rarely feel anxious or cranky? And if that's true, how so? That's what I call a two-footed question, which again, I invented. So Harvard put it up on their website, as did several other universities, but they've given me credit for it. And it's a two-footed question, which gets you moving, Carrie, not just passively like university memorizing some chemistry formula to give back on an exam and never let it act itself or animate itself in your brain or mind. Not that. That's what bores teens and keeps them passive. So we have to ask the most intelligent questions. Then we have to target our improvements. We have to target something. You can't just say, I'm going to use eight intelligences. I didn't see your target. What was it? What problem were you trying to solve? Was it trying to solve the problem of panic in your life? If it was, then target that and let's see the improvement from where you stood to where you hope to go. And then I'll measure that and I'll be able to give you a very fair assessment. You'll no longer question my assessment. And then the third phase of the five-phase model, one of those being intelligences, is what do you expect? What do I expect? Do I expect to be less panicky, or do I expect to have no crankiness in my day? What do I expect? I need to maybe list three or four things I'd like to see visibly in my solution to the problem. And that I'm very specific about as well. And then the fourth is move your resources. And that includes Gardner's eight intelligences, Carrie, but I'm sorry to say that's not all of it. You have to move your other mental resources. What does that have to do with serotonin? Well, I teach and show and illustrate and try to live how you can get more of your serotonin. I teach how you can overtake using those mental resources, which I call move them. I want to see them activated. If you move them, you will be able to overtake things in your DNA that you were fearful of. Maybe too many people had Alzheimer's, too many people were drunks, too many people had chronic cortisol, like in my family. How do you overcome those? There's a way to do it. You have to, in my world, you have to move those pneumongos off their butts. And once those pneumongos get moved off their butts, you've got it. And then you're laughing, but it's happening. And you can laugh with people that it's happening. And then the final one is to reflect on your growth possibilities. One system that has never reflected well, Carrie, I don't like the idea of blame, so I'll blame myself as much as I'm talking about anybody else. But the education system has never learned to reflect on its growth possibilities and then make changes so that they could line up what they do with how the brain operates. I remember a few years ago being invited to the Caribbean to be their speaker of the year. My topic was to be, how can your model change higher education? And I remember I had a very stiff drink before I even was going to say, and so when I got there, I thought, this is so impossible. I'm one little street kid who's now grown up, and I'm down here in the Caribbean with a whole bunch of scholars who are probably all smarter than me, and I'm going to tell them how to change the system. We all had a lot of good laughs about it, and I hope I left them with a few takeaways. But once we get this operational, we never go back. Like, we're like Martin Luther King, been to the mountaintop, seeing God, not going back. You know, we get like that.
Okay. What is the name of your new book?
The new book is called The Teens Growth Mindset Workbook. There are other workbooks out there. So this one has got blue bricks on the cover, and it's The Teens Growth Mindset Workbook. It's a book that is also, it's in many of the bookstores. So it's a book that's to be read, but it isn't like your typical workbook where it's not on Kindle, for example. It is. The company that put this book out in New York is very well known for how well they do. I'm very pleased with the work they did with that book. And so it's a book that allows teens to very actively interact, simply because if it wasn't that, I would be going against everything I believe about how the brain works. Mm-hmm. The brain works doesn't work by taking notes and listening. The brain works by activating something, being cheered on by a coach who's a cheerleader, and then laughing at your failures and laughing at life's failures and not blaming yourself, being kind to yourself, accessing kindness. And so that's some of the things the book does.
So of course we want people to buy this book, and it's available everywhere, but give us like two important lessons in that book, like two things you want parents to know and pass on to their teenagers.
Well, I like how you say parents to know and pass on, because I think this book works really well if an elderly grandparent like me sits with a teenager and does it with them. I'm getting word back from the grandparents saying, I was changed more than my teenage grandson. And when that happens, and when you present that way to a teenager, there's growth for everybody, but there's also fun for everybody. So that book comes with the activities that will roll out fun between you and an adult that you trust. It allows you to measure your multiple intelligences, for example, see which ones are high, which are low, and how you can laugh at the low ones and grow them up. It helps you to awaken and access your inner kindness in an unfair world. That means you'll grow grit and resilience. I did it by accident and by faith and by other people's goodness, but we should not rely on other people to grow our grit and resilience. Even as teens, it's really up to us to do it. This book shows how we can do that in an unfair world. I can't change the entire education system, but I can help folks navigate within it in an unfair world by accessing their own kindness and their own capabilities. And it also gives the teens, like, for example, very practical things like a study hack so they can hack their boredom and study in a way that they love, that makes sense, that gets them a higher grade on their next chemistry exam.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by that, like a study hack? Like, tell us a story related to that. Have you heard from anyone who's used it? Have you tried it with your kids? Like, give me a story related to that so we can understand better.
Well, some of the study hacks I use relate to the mnemongos. I show how the mnemongos work and you can get them alive in your brain. I won't do that now. We don't have time, Carrie, but it turned out that what it resulted in was a diagram that I could draw while I was studying. I know the brain has a working memory that only holds a few pieces of data. So if I try to memorize 5 pages, I'm bored, it's long, it's arduous, it's not fun, and it doesn't help me to solve everyday problems after the exam is over. I typically forget what is rote memorized. So what I teach the students to do is to read carefully 2 or 3 pages they know or is likely going to be on the exam, and then to make a mental, even if it's stick people, a mental diagram on the side of their scrap paper, and then label each, if it's a stick human, label the human's arms, legs, and head with 5 words that trigger a paragraph each from you. It's wired and wild. And then take it into the exam. And here's how you can use a cheat sheet. After the exam is passed out, only after it's passed out using your intrapersonal ethics, you then draw your little stick human on the side of your exam paper that you're going to take away. And then you label each of the 5, and then you quietly settle into the calm of serotonin to write away and get your cheat. You keep looking back to cheat off your own diagram. You can do the same kind of thing through a boring lecture. Nobody should be lecturing to anybody. That's not how we learn. But you can do the same thing if you start to learn that if you would go in with a question like, what one thing in this lecture could I do to make life funner? If you're a teen, you might say the word funner, more fun after.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're an adult or a parent, you might say that would make me wiser later, whichever, it doesn't matter. You go in with the idea of captivating a key point, and then you draw that key point in the margin and you write one sentence about that key point that you will try later that day and then test yourself on. In other words, if I said, I'm going to build an airplane, then how did that airplane turn out? If you said, I'm going to create a way to look and measure the water in my tap, then you create the diagram for yourself and how you're going to relate it to your life and use it. Once you do that, it's your baby. That baby's yours, and it stays within your brain because it goes from your working memory that night in REM into your basal ganglia.
Oh my gosh, my mind is absolutely blown.
Oh dear.
That is so good.
It's fun.
So, so good. You talk a lot. I'm going to say you're speaking my love language when you talk about serotonin and about the stress hormone.
Cortisol.
Cortisol and the relationship to your gut health and the impact. For anyone listening who doesn't understand what they are and how important they are in their lives, can you break it down for us, Ellen, and define each of them?
Of course I can. Serotonin is our brain's aha chemical. It's our brain's well-being chemical. It's our brain's contentment, joy, peace, confidence, inner kindness. It's our goodwill chemical. And in teams, we cultivate serotonin by not carrying on with the negative statement that was said, but maybe making one kind word without diminishing the person who said a negative statement. We might say, I was thinking about how that could work if we, and then throw in one adjustment that might make that criticized thing work for you. That would be a serotonin turnaround. So you can build up and create and cultivate more serotonin by the cognitive things you do carry, but that's not all. There's more excitement to it. We know that it's a neurotransmitter and it regulates our sleep. It's the thing that gives us the moods we need or gets us out of the moods that we hate. And it helps our memory. The people that are my age saying I'm having memory loss, it has nothing to do with age often and a lot to do with not cultivating the kind of serotonin goodwill that our brains need. It's important for our body temperature, muscle concentration, but we can get it through the foods we eat.
Yeah.
We can get it through running up a set of stairs instead of standing quietly on an elevator, we can get more of it by being deliberate about not replaying. Did you ever, Carrie, replay a ticker tape about somebody who did you in quietly? And maybe, yeah, they just did you in, and maybe they didn't even intend to. It's not important, but they did do you in. And then you play it like a ticker tape going across your forehead. It's just going all day long. Yeah. And by the end of the day, you are, without any conditions, you are the hero of that story to yourself. But it's a miserable story to yourself where you're blaming the world. You're a hero, but you're not.
It sucks the life out of you.
Absolutely. It sucks the energy out of the room. You said it better than me. It sucks the energy out of the room. And so that is your cortisol. Now, if you deliberately say, I am going to go and have a little bowl of Jell-O because that's what I love right now, even a little bowl of ice cream or a small glass of wine. I am going to turn this into something good for myself. Now, if you stay at that table and drink four glasses of wine, you've given yourself right back into the cortisol pool. You've made yourself miserable. You've made yourself waking up in cortisol. You've shut down a lot of things. Cortisol literally shuts down your brain. So if you were giving a podcast and your person came late and you so much as looked at your watch like that, that is a cortisol trigger for the person who came in. Maybe his mother or her mother had a heart attack. We don't know. But if we come at that person with mercy and grace, the way a person wrote a check for $60,000, unfathomable in my mind. I couldn't write that to pay off a mortgage. I just could not do it. But he did it. It sent so much serotonin back to himself, serotonin to me, to the banker. So it's all in our action. Then when we go to sleep at night, we have a half hour of light sleep. Then we go into a half hour of deep REM sleep, rapid eye movement, where all the brain's work happens. And we take all the short term or working memory bits of information we did that day, and it gets transferred into our basal ganglia, which is our backpack of long-term memory, everything we've ever done in life, packs it into the backpack. And so you want to replace things in your backpack that are negative, judgmental, angry, moody, unkind to yourself. Our inner critic is usually far worse than our criticism of anybody else. But without and without that kindness and mercy and grace to ourselves, we have no reservoir of that for anybody else. It's so exciting.
It is. And it's two things that I really just like that I talk about all the time. Serotonin, I talk to people about, it's your happy hormones. It's the things that make you happy and give you that boost. I go to my kids, go and pet our dog Sienna because it's going to boost your serotonin level. Or go do it. It's for those people that want to buy a coffee for someone who's in line at Tim Hortons and they're in front of you and they don't even know that you did this. If that's a serotonin boost. On the flip side, when your stress level goes through the roof, that's when the cortisol shoots through your veins. Yes. It can also slow down your metabolism and cause you to gain weight when the cortisol is constantly pumping through your body. So I love digging into that. We can talk about that all day.
So, well, it should be talked about more than a day. It should be talked about all month, because you look at the next time you go to Targets or McDonald's, you look at the little two-year-old who throws him or herself on the floor in a tantrum because we don't know what's bothering. Maybe they want a candy at the checkout shop, whatever. But the parent who stands and does this now puts bucket of cortisol onto cortisol. Yeah. The parent who gives in and gives the bag of candy this the child was screaming for, that cortisol is now long-term, and that child will hold on to it long-term. The parent who removes the child from the situation and shows a huggable little toy on the other side of the counter that they or in the basket that they already own that they could hold, that parent has understood the true meaning of cortisol and serotonin. I taught it to my very, very young grandchildren in those kind of ways, because every one of us will get dumped on by cortisol. And that, whether you like it or not, that's research shows that we have at least 22 stressors a day. Picture our darling teens, 22 stressors a day. I name what those might be in the book. I also include 40 or so letters from other teens who describe the typical problems of teenagers and a growth mindset response that could help them out. So if you look at the fact that research shows you have at least 22 stressors, whether you like it or not, they get they're like a punch in the gut, a gut punch. MIG is another one of the mnemonics for a good reason. MIG is your amygdala, and that's where you store every response. If you scream when the spider walks in front of you, you've just stored your scream. Anytime you panic, you now are more, you have a propensity for jumping, you'll reuse that response. It's already stored in your amygdala storehouse. It's just dynamic when you think about. So you want to go around smiling all day like a Cheshire cat, even if you're feeling down. You want to treat yourself to every delight, even if you feel you can't, because you want to keep storing responses in your amygdala that will come when you're in a tantrum state or when somebody dumps a whole bucket of stressors on you.
Ellen, I want to close with this question about your book, but like for parents whose teenagers are struggling, and you alluded to this at the beginning of this conversation, that so many of them want to be perfect. Yes. And I hate that word.
And their parents really want them to be perfect. How many A's did you get? You get $2 for every A.
There's no such thing as perfect. There just isn't. I don't use the word. It puts this unbelievable amount of stress and pressure on their lives. But for parents of teenagers who are really, really struggling, what do you want them to know? What do you want them to take away from this conversation? Give them hope.
For the first time, I feel like I want to shed a tear because I have been working with such parents all my life, good people. And many of the parents don't have the equipment themselves. By that, I mean, they are not good to themselves. They give to everybody else out of an empty toolbox because they don't have the tools to cultivate. So what I tried to do in the book, I list resources for parents who are struggling. I show parents how they can adopt a shared language, which is a growth mindset language in this book, with a teenager. Carrie, if you and I, who come from such different backgrounds, I admire so much of what you've done, how you've learned, how you've led. And when we share a language as we have in the last 3 weeks, there's something amazing can happen between you and I, and it has happened between you and I. And that's what a parent can expect, even with an angry teenager. Teenagers are angry because they're angry inside. And so this book allows a language to be shared that's a fun language that doesn't judge and say, you are cranky again, you are not eating your dinner until you get that expression off your face. That is an old-fashioned, non-usable, cortisol-driven, angry response to an angry teen that's going to make the teen want to run away and the parent want to dump his head in a bucket. And so the way that we do it is by looking inside the brain to see how the mnemonics are going on. I'm now writing my final book in life and I'm including the mnemonics in it. I'm sad I did not put them in my teen book. I didn't. There was so much to write. They gave me such a short time to write it and I didn't. But I have it on my site and I have references to videos of my mnemonics in action so people can see that. But I think that it's getting a shared language. Don't write me a review and say, I really love this book, but my teenager is bored. Help your teenager to be enthused about a grace mindset that could serve him or her well, a grace mindset that could work in his or her favor, and let your teen know they already possess all that they need to make that happen. They don't need a gift from me. You don't need anything from me, Carrie. You already possess probably more of what I have in my DNA for moving these ideas forward. But what we do need is to figure out how to access and awaken that which is now known about the brain through MRIs and all of these other X-ray dimensions that we can see that I started this 50 years ago. Research has caught up with me and we can now see them in action.
So the book is called The Growth Mindset.
that no, because there is one called the growth mindset yes. for teens. It's called the teens growth mindset, the teens growth mindset yes. workbook, even the teens growth mindset workbook. And another one somehow came out at the same time. I should go and read it. I'm sure it's got lots to offer me, but it's got some of the same words as the title of mine, which is okay. the teens growth mindset workbook.
Everybody, go buy it. Go support Ellen Weber. You are absolutely brilliant. I have so enjoyed this conversation and the chance to meet you and have you step into my world and my life the way that you did. Thank you so much for stepping into the inner circle and sharing your incredible learnings and teachings with all of us. I appreciate you.
Back at you. Thank you so much, Kiri. All the best to everything you do worldwide.
And to you, Ellen. Thank you.
I want to end today by extending my gratitude to you for listening. You know, time is our most precious commodity. We don't have enough of it most days. So I am so grateful that you shared some of your precious time with me. Thank you so much. For show notes and links to our guests and everything we talked about today, you can head to my website, carriedoll.co. That is CarrieDoll.co. Once you're there, you can find links to Instagram and Facebook. You can sign up for my newsletters and get information on my public speaking courses. I want to empower women and people everywhere to use their voice, to invest in themselves, and to be comfortable anytime, anywhere, giving a powerful, unforgettable speech. Come with me. Join the movement of the inner circle. Let's go on this journey together.
Produced and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com.
And listen to our podcasts wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.